I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. As lifelong Disney fans, the work of countless talented Disney creatives have shaped our lives.
Now, as the Disney catalog expands, we're taking a journey through film and television to discover if that spark that shaped us as children lives on in adulthood.
Does your favorite Disney media still cast that same spell? Join us as we find out. We are
Rewatching the Magic. May the 4th be with you, Kiki!
May the 4th be with you, Tuesday!
Yay! But before we get into all that Star Wars stuff, we do have some stuff that we need to quickly get through. First off, the Logan Awards, the Logan Whitehurst Memorial Awards for Excellence in Comedy Music. Nominations are open. Go to loganawards.com for more information. But we are not alone, Kiki.
It is our old friend, our good friend, possibly our very first listener.
Our first fan.
The very wonderful Adam Liebrick-Johnson.
Yay! Hello! And may the 4th be with you.
Yay. All right, so let's get to some stuff that came out since our last recording. How about that Falcon Winter Soldier finale?
Oh my god.
Loved it!
So good.
It was awesome. I know there are some people who have their issues with it, that it didn't stick the landing, that maybe it needed one more episode, and maybe it did, but I think that this six-hour format that Marvel is doing is working. I really loved it. I really liked the story they had with Sam. I'm still on the fence of John Walker as a character. I feel like while many people say he had a redemption in the final episodes, I don't believe he did.
Yeah, kind of a half-assed redemption.
He thinks he's redeemed, but it's like he didn't really learn anything.
I learned something today, and what I learned was nothing.
Yeah, but again, we will likely see more of these characters in the future. I think our big thing was Falcon and Winter Soldier. Thumbs up.
Yes, yeah, very big thumbs up. What I had read was that the reason it might have seemed like they didn't stick the landing was because they had an entire B plot they had to cut about a global pandemic for some reason.
Yeah, the what I've read was that one of the Flag Smashers' plan was to do a man-made virus that would be released and that would stop the plan of the government, which, yeah.
They had for to some cut reason, all that they didn't feel like that was appropriate at this day and age.
Yeah. But ultimately, I really enjoyed what they produced, and we are going to see more because Captain America 4 has been announced. All we know is that it's a Captain America movie and that the team behind Falcon and Winter Soldier will be producing this movie.
And I'm assuming Anthony Mackie is going to be starring, right?
I assume so.
He is signed on. So he will be in the movie.
I mean, he is Captain America now.
Yeah. As Mackie says, cut the check.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. It should lead directly from the end of Falcon and Winter Soldier directly into Captain America 4, from what I've heard. So if you want to be ready for that movie, go get prepared and watch that series.
So what would you want or expect from this movie, a Sam Wilson movie?
I am personally scared to answer that question because you asked me what I wanted from Falcon and Winter Soldier, and I said I wanted them to spend a lot of time in therapy as a joke, and yeah, so I'm a little terrified to make any more MCU predictions at this point. I'm a little weirded out that I may be accidentally creating the MCU in my head.
Yeah, maybe. Some people have came up with their ideas, but I'm gonna. I thought about this. What I wanted to see, and I want to see Captain America and the Falcon. What I mean is, we've seen Joaquin Torres in the show, which is, you know, Sam's friend in the military. We saw what he has now. He does become the Falcon in the comics after Sam became Cap. So let's do a movie with those two characters and see what we can come up with.
Is Joaquin Torres the first Gen Z hero in the MCU?
I assume so. I mean, in the comics, he was a teenager. Obviously, he's not that in the movie.
But he's like 19 or something.
Something like that.
Yeah, he's pretty young in the series. So,
mm-hmm. So I
could be down for that. That'd be great. You know?
A lot of people have been talking about Young Avengers, so this could be the next part of that process.
I would be totally down for Black Captain America and Latino Falcon. And
yeah.
That'd be cool.
All right, let's move on. The Oscars just passed, and Soul won Best Animated Feature. Congratulations to Soul.
And congratulations to John Batiste.
Yeah.
That was kind of cool.
Yeah.
I have feelings about Soul, but for the most part, it was okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be nice if Disney and Pixar could let a black person be a black person for an entire movie.
Oh, yeah. We have discussed that on the show, as you well know.
We know that 22 versus the Earth, the short based off the movie, is coming out. Will already be out by the time this episode airs. From the trailer, it looks like it's going to be hilarious.
Yeah, the trailer was cute. I liked it.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to the big story of the week, this Disney Sony deal.
Yeah, we've speculated about this for a while, that when the Sony, Spider-Man and some of their other stuff ran its course on Netflix, if it would move over to Disney Plus, and it looks like, yes, indeed it will.
So yeah, a couple of weeks ago, Sony and Netflix made a deal that all of the new movies that are be coming out starting in 2022 would go to Netflix after the theatrical run and after its home media run. That it would go to Netflix, and it looks like those movies will be going to Disney Plus after their Netflix run. And this also means, looks like a lot of the back catalog of Sony is also going to go to other Disney services. Disney Plus, Hulu, also the television networks, Disney Channel, Freeform, ABC, and all of them.
Yeah.
So this is a big deal for that, and also because we talked about Spider-Man and Sony, but Sony also owns two of the Muppet movies.
Yes.
The Muppet Takes Manhattan and Muppets from Space. So not only to complete the MCU, but to complete the theatrical Muppet movies on Disney Plus.
That would be awesome.
I really need Muppets from Space on Disney Plus, y'all.
Yes.
Yes, I mean, think of all the other movies that Sony owns that could be coming to Disney Plus. I mean, Ghostbusters, Men in Black, Look Who's Talking.
I mean, you lost me on that last one, but you had me up until then.
It's certainly a change of heart from back after Far From Home, when Sony was saying they were going to put Spider-Man and allow Spider-Man in any more MCU movies.
Yeah. Who knows? I mean, who knows? And as far as I'm aware, this could start as soon as June, as it looks like a number of Sony movies will be hitting Hulu in June. I don't know if it's part of this deal or what. So as when this episode is going to be airing, Disneyland will be open to the public again. California residents only, as we've heard. They are the only ones that have been kind of hard on this California residents thing, because the state of California has said that if you are vaccinated, that they will allow out-of-state people, visitors, to come to the parks. Just as we are recording this, Universal Hollywood has announced that they will allow out-of-state guests, provided that they show proof of vaccination. So that's a big deal, but Disney is being very headstrong on they will only allow California residents. And from what I've been seeing from the preview days, that they are in fact checking IDs. Speaking of the preview day, again, we are recording this before April 30th. Adam, you were able to go to the cast member preview day.
That is correct. Thanks to the generosity of a cast member that I happen to know, we were able to go to the cast member previews at Disneyland, and it was at times extremely surreal being out in a crowd that large again. And it was, for the most part, a very smoothly operating day. They had everything set up pretty well to begin with. It looks like they'd rehearsed everything pretty well, and they've measured out the distancing markers appropriately. And except for a couple minor hiccups, the day went very smoothly, and I felt very safe there.
How many people do you think were roughly there?
I don't know. They haven't obviously released any attendance numbers, but they say they're at about 25% capacity. And that is a very small number of people in the parks, probably less than 9,000, which makes the park seem fairly empty, except it did look like there were more people there than there actually were because of the way the distancing was being handled, and the lines were marked out so that it seemed like an extremely long line, but was really only between like 10 and 30 minutes long.
So I've seen some of the park tubers go there, and it looked like really mostly empty lines for some of the more well-known rides, with the exception of pretty much anything Star Wars and the new refurbished Snow White's Enchanted Wish.
Yes, which I did not get to go on Snow White's Enchanted Wish. My wife is there again today, and she's making that a priority. We just sort of ran out of time because we weren't really rushing to do anything. We were just sort of enjoying being somewhere that's not our condo.
Well, quickly, what's your opinion on the taking the scary out of Snow White's Scary Adventure?
I kind of disagree with it, but also I think that whatever they do, it's going to look good. So it's always been sort of a weird, quirky attraction, especially the Disneyland version. And they updated it once before, I think in the 80s, and that's when it got to the scary moniker. And it's always kind of an interesting attraction because the story doesn't end on the attraction; it just sort of stops.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been on it, but I have seen videos which just the last part is just the old witch pushing over a rock and squashing you and killing you.
Yeah, and then she's supposedly falling backwards to her death, and then it ends with a mural of Snow White and the prince, who has up to that point not shown up in the ride. It's just he's just there as a mural at the exit.
And yeah,
that's kind of what it's like in the movie.
Yeah.
Well, the new version, he actually has an animatronic in the ride. As I've told Kiki once, one ride, it's the witch is throwing a rock at you and killing you, and right next door is Mr. Toad's wild ride where you end up going to hell.
Which I saw a very lovely Twitter post the other day that said they're retheming that to Lil Nas X's Wild Ride, which I would actually like to see.
That'd be great.
So what were you able to do at Disneyland during that preview day?
We unlike Disney World, they're allowing park hopping here, which means you have to pick a park to start your day in, and then at 1 p.m. you're allowed to go to the other park. And we started at California Adventure. I rode Guardians of the Galaxy Mission Breakout, which is really good. Then we were able to get on the Incredicoaster and the Little Mermaid attraction. And then we headed over to Disneyland. We had lunch there, and then we headed over to Disneyland, and we were able to do Haunted Mansion, Pirates of the Caribbean, Rise of the Resistance, Millennium Falcon, Smuggler's Run. And then if we had put more effort in, we probably could have gotten most of the park done. But like I said, we were just enjoying being somewhere not in our two bedrooms.
I know that you said you felt like they had handled it pretty well, and they had marked the distance and out and everything. But this was cast members and their specifically invited guests who know that they are there at the very good graces of someone whose employment may be dependent on how they act that day.
Yeah.
How do you think it's going to work once it starts being, regular Joes back in the park?
I don't know. From what I've seen, for the most part, it seems to work well in Florida, except for the occasional news story about some guy throwing a fit because he spent money on his vacation and was then not allowed to not wear a mask. I think it'll go pretty okay. The cast members were very attentive. I did see on one or two occasions somebody not wearing a mask where they were not supposed to, because you're only allowed to take off your mask while you're eating or drinking in a designated area. And they're not allowing people to eat or drink while they walk. And I noticed a couple people were called for that. And it seemed like the cast members were being very attentive to that sort of thing. And people were very politely acknowledging that and putting and covering their faces back up. So it's it seems like it'll go well. There were certainly some people who weren't happy with it. I saw some eye rolls from some people, but like I said, for the most part, the cast members were being polite and firm, and the guests were being receptive to it.
Well, I do hope that continues.
And most of California, at least most of Southern California, seems to be doing okay with people obeying the rules, except for some exceptions. Looking at you, Orange County.
Yeah.
And Disney is actually being stricter than the California and county mandates are being. For example, indoor dining is being allowed in California right now, but Disney's not allowing it. None of their indoor restaurants are open right now, and their social distancing markers are 8 feet apart as opposed to the standard 6 feet, and they're 8 feet in all directions, which leads to some very interesting line experiences.
Hmm. Want to guess what it's like in Georgia right now?
Not particularly, no.
That's probably for the best.
Speaking of customer complaints, Kiki, you want to take this one?
So I don't have the story right in front of me, but there is a gentleman in Florida who apparently loves Disney. And he loves Disney so much that he is very, very sad that Disney has ruined his childhood, his very quite childhood, his very 1950s childhood, his very homogenous childhood, what with all their recent woke changes. And we would just like to say, from our podcast to this guy, whatever his name is, it's not worth reporting, because honestly, we don't care about him. Dude, shut up.
Yes.
This is the unproductive dunking section of the show. I just wanted to mention this guy and unproductively dunk on him, because this man is ridiculous. As you know, if you've listened to more than 30 seconds of this podcast, we're actually loving these changes at Disney. We talked about the cast member clothing changes, the fact that people can wear their hairstyle that they want now, and
shoulder tattoos, yeah,
beards and tattoos, and male identified people can wear fingernail polish and skirts, and we're removing racist depictions.
My brother-in-law ordered nail polish specifically because of that.
That's amazing. I love that.
I saw a friend of mine when we were writing Rise of the Resistance. She was in a First Order uniform with an undercut, and it looked amazing.
That sounds great. I would love pictures of that. I'm glad that they're, you know, I think you specifically mentioned Trader Sam.
Trader Sam on the Jungle Cruise is being removed in Florida and Disneyland, and being replaced with a lost and found / gift shop scene.
That is called Trader Sam. So
yeah, he's there in spirit. Trader Sam will be referenced with name. Just the racist caricature will not be visible there.
Mm. Which is great. Love it. Thanks, Disney. And he also really, really hated that Splash Mountain is being turned into, you know, Tiana's wonderful splash bog ride or whatever.
Because we all need Song of the South to continue to be referenced.
Yeah, I mean, we've already talked about that change so much.
One movie we won't do on this show.
Yeah. So,
I believe one line that guy had in his op-ed was, I'm not paying money to see somebody I don't know express themselves.
Yes, that was...
Aren't you going to see people perform? Isn't that expressing themselves? And also, I saw a male presenting cast member in a skirt at Disneyland yesterday, and it was awesome.
Cool. Also, for those of you who are assigned male at birth and may have those particular parts that would lead you to be assigned male at birth, may I recommend skirts as an item of clothing, kilts and other skirt type things in hot weather, such as may be found in California or Florida? It is very comfortable in hot and humid temperatures for the bits and the areas. Please avail yourself of those things. It will keep you cool.
Good enough for the Scots.
Yeah. And they don't even live in a hot and humid area. Trust me, I know many, many reenactors at Ren fairs and other medieval type things down here. Once they put on a kilt or a long tunic or other things like that, they never go back. They're like, I have never been so comfortable in 117 degree weather with 98% humidity. So maybe let the Disney cast members who are standing out in that weather for 12 hours a day do that.
Yeah,
they just finally allowed them to carry a water bottle with them on stage.
Oh, good finally. Grief.
That had been the rule in Florida for a while, and California finally caught up with it because it's just getting bonkers hot here.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
One more thing I did want to think about Disney. Did you pass Toontown?
I did not pass Toontown, unfortunately.
So, because I wanted to see if it's true what they're saying about the construction of Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway. The show building is up, and to hide the show building, they had a like little wink and nudge under construction sign with Mickey doing a winky facing building. What building? I don't see a building here.
That is the case. I saw a friend of mine took a picture of it when they were there, and I have seen a picture of it, and it's marvelous. It's so much better than just painting it go away green.
Mm-hmm. Oh, or blue. That's very adorable.
But yeah, they'll probably put the pieces that'll hide the building within the next few months or so.
So anyway, have we finished dunking and talking about things? And
sure, let's talk about Space Wizards.
Space Wizards! My favorite topic.
Yeah, so we are talking about The Empire Strikes Back. Last year we did the first Star Wars movie. It just makes sense for us to do it, the second movie, The Empire Strikes Back, right here on May the 4th. Excuse me.
I accidentally watched The Wrath of Khan. Is that okay?
Sure. yeah, Empire Strikes Back. The only movie of the original trilogy not to be directed by George Lucas. And many people say it's all the better for it.
No, I am one of those people.
Irvin Kershner did a wonderful job with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot of what people really liked about this movie was really Irvin's idea. The you know, I love you, I know, that was him and Harrison Ford came up with that idea. The original script had Han saying, I love you too, which, fine, but it's kind of out of character, which I agree with.
Especially Han's characterization in this movie. He's being kind of a pest through most of it.
Yeah, I got some stuff to say about that, but we'll get to it. So, it's Star Wars. Everyone's seen Star Wars. Everyone knows Star Wars. Depending on who you are, you might love it, you might hate it, you might love to hate it. Who knows? I mean, where do you go? How do you begin this conversation about Empire Strikes Back?
Well, you want to talk about the kind of one actor in this movie we've not talked about on the show before?
Yeah, we've talked about pretty much every actor in this movie. Mark Hamill, Carrie Fisher, Harrison Ford.
Frank Oz joins us for this one.
Yeah, Frank Oz is Yoda.
James Earl Jones.
Yeah, James Earl Jones. But yeah, let's talk about the new actor, the new kid on the block here, Billy Dee Williams.
Ricardo Montalban.
Alright, so
Lando Calrissian.
Yeah, Billy Dee Williams, Lando Calrissian, aka the only black guy in the galaxy for a very long time. So he started out on Broadway. Interestingly, at one point on Broadway, he was the replacement for James Earl Jones. He took up for James Earl Jones. So there you go. But started out on Broadway and then broke into film in a movie called Last Angry Man. Spent a long part of his career in the 60s being really annoyed that every time he would go for an audition, the role went to Sidney Poitier. So he decided he was going to just drop acid.
As you do.
As you do.
What's the 70s?
But he eventually kind of came off of that and finally broke through in 71 in the very well received film Brian's Song. It was a television film instead of a feature role, but it was such a huge cultural moment in the 70s that it really just shot Billy Dee Williams right into stardom. It was a really important story about friendship between men, which was not really a thing that you had, you know, like really cool platonic love between men. And also platonic love between men of different races. Also a thing you didn't really see at the time. So he got a contract with Berry Gordy over at Motown Records. And then really started to become a sex symbol in a lot of blaxploitation movies. And then ended up getting cast as Lando.
He did use that sex appeal for some TV commercials later on, as he became the spokesman for Colt 45 malt liquor.
Dee Williams talks about Colt 45.
There are two rules to remember if you want to have a good time. Rule number one, never run out of Colt 45. Rule number two, never forget rule number one.
Oh,
works
yeah.
Works every time.
But
there's no way I can be as smooth as him saying that, though.
No.
But he was really the epitome of cool when he got cast as Lando.
Really, the first Star Wars, mostly everyone in that movie was an unknown. This was really one of the first times they used a relatively known actor in these movies.
Yeah, this was stunt casting.
Yeah.
It was like, hey, see this cool guy? See this cool guy you know? Yeah. He's Han Solo's friend. it was kind of awesome. And it really cemented that Star Wars wasn't just a flash in the pan. Mm-hmm. This was, you know, Empire was to see, is Star Wars just a one-off novelty, or is Star Wars going to have some staying power?
Well, after that, we talked about it before, you know, the toy selling out, and they hadn't even made him yet.
Yeah.
You know, they were selling an empty box, saying, here's what the toys are going to look like. We don't have them yet, but everyone wants them, so here's the thing.
And there were people asking Lucas immediately after the movie came out, so when's Star Wars 2?
Yeah, little did we know, it was actually Star Wars 5.
Yeah. But I'm going to say that although we do make the joke, and for good reason, that he's the only black guy in the galaxy, it is notable that Lando is a very complex character. He's suave, he's got swag, but he's not a one note, and he's not a racial stereotype.
No, they have him kind of like the main guy of Cloud City. They say he's an ambassador, but he has a lot of political power on that world.
He says he's the administrator.
So he's kind of the head honcho of Cloud City, at least. And yep. he has his businesses, and yeah, he was a scoundrel like Han, but he, for lack of a better term, went legit, or as legit as you can when you're trying to avoid being a part of the Empire.
He does mention that some of his customers would prefer to avoid Imperial entanglements.
Yeah. And that's kind of his story. Like, in order to protect his people, he makes it a literal deal with the devil and trying to, you know, giving up Han and Leia to Vader just so the Empire will leave his people alone.
Yeah. He quickly realizes he's in over his head because Vader keeps
altering the deal,
keeps changing things to suit himself, and there's nothing Lando can do about it.
Yeah, again, he really can't, because the minute he gets out of line, who knows what the Empire is going to do to Cloud City.
And he does seem very concerned about the people in Cloud City.
I mean, we see at the when he's able to escape from the troopers, he immediately puts out a message all over the city: the Empire is here. Get out of the city.
Feds are coming. Cheese it.
You know? It's like,
which I like. He's very concerned about Leia, and while at first it's very much like, "Hey, pretty lady, what's up?" You very quickly discover that he cares about her as a person. Mm-hmm. He's very concerned about her safety. He considers her competent.
And he cares about Han, too, even though he sold him down the river.
Yeah, and he respects her love for Han. Mm-hmm. You know, he's kind of ribbing Han of like, you know, oh yeah, I'm going to take your woman. But you can tell that, like, once he realizes, like, oh, Han's serious about this girl, he backs off.
Yeah.
You know, there's respect there, which I like.
And part of that deal is, you know, to make sure that Leia and Chewie are safe, even though, and he knows that Han has a bounty on his head. There's nothing he can do about that, but he can at least keep Leia and Chewie safe before, again, Vader changes the deal again.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, he's got Lobot there,
mm-hmm.
and even though we don't know it in the movie, you know, and it's always weird talking about the Legends stuff, because there's always so much question about, like, you know, Lucas says he always had this stuff in the back of his brain, but the authors are like, no, I came up with this, and, you know, so it's always kind of a bit weird trying to suss out exactly what pieces were in place when.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is that Lobot's, you know, little cyborg implants are that he is a kind of battle strategy genius.
Mm.
And that he sort of escaped from the Empire because he didn't want to do battle strategy for the Empire anymore. So that he's kind of been living a quiet life with Lando, but that when Lando gives him that little wink and the nod in the carbonite chamber, when Vader's like, oh no, I'm keeping Leia, pray I don't alter the deal any further, and Lando gives Lobot that look, that is absolutely the look of, like, you've been running the numbers on this, right? Because we're about to throw down.
Yeah, it's a blink and you'll miss it moment where he kind of touches a little wrist computer and sends a message to Lobot.
But that is considered by many who have kind of read the, you know, all the Legends stuff, that Lobot has been running all the odds on stuff and running all these battle strategies at every step along the way to counter Vader. And so Lando was always running a plan to keep Han safe.
There's evidence for that in current canon too, because in Rebels there's an Imperial data cruncher who's got a cyborg headpiece like Lobot's, and he's played by Dave Filoni actually, and he's a the same kind of thing, strategizing, running numbers, calculating odds, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so I think we were supposed to get the feeling even then, even kind of discounting, you know, the later stuff about Lobot. I do feel that there's enough in the movie to say Lando always had a plan. Like, he didn't just hang Han out to dry. Mm-hmm. Now, the plan didn't work. There were too many moving pieces. You know, he didn't account for Fett, maybe, and, you know, all that other kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But that Lando was doing his best to do an end run around Vader.
Speaking of Fett, the name Boba Fett is never said once in this movie. He's just called the Bounty Hunter.
I believe they call him by name in the holiday special, which came out before this.
We've talked about the holiday special. But, yeah, if you didn't see the holiday special, you wouldn't know this character's name, or unless you bought the toy.
Yeah. And yeah, he's not mentioned by name in...
He wouldn't be mentioned by name in the movies until Jedi.
Yep.
Speaking of Boba Fett, let's talk about these changes. Because this had the least amount of story changes of the original trilogy, but there was still some notable changes.
This movie has both my favorite and one of my least favorite special edition changes in it.
So we have, you know, obviously Jeremy Bullock as in the suit as Boba Fett. Originally, we had Jason Wingreen doing the voice. And then for the special edition, they changed it up to, what's that actor's name?
Tamora Morrison.
Yes, Tamora Morrison, who played Jango Fett as they were filming Attack of the Clones at the time. Makes sense, considering it's a clone and all that. But it's one of those... You know, everyone's going to have their own their own critiques on the changes.
I was not a fan of that particular change at first, but I think I've grown to like it more as time has gone on, and I've seen some more stuff like the Clone Wars with the Jango inspired clones, and later things like The Mandalorian with spoiler alert in it. And
I'm going to say that I have a kind of a personal connection to Jeremy Bullock that I hold very, very dear. And so I take that change much, much harder than I think a lot of people would. So it does get to me watching it. Because I have such incredibly fond and profound memories of Jeremy. And so that loss personally, but also in the films, is just absolutely gut-wrenching for me.
Speaking of actor changes, the Emperor, the original 1980s, whatever that was, version of the Emperor versus... The Ian McDermott.
The original one had chimpanzee eyes.
Yeah, an actress named Marjorie Eaton was the actual face, and they superimposed chimpanzee eyes over her, and Clive Revel was the original voice. But for the special edition, they just got Ian McDermott, put him in the costume. He's still look more or less the same.
The dialogue is incredibly clunky in the special edition, and I hate it. I hate it so much.
Yeah, they change it up. You know, we have a new enemy, Luke Skywalker.
It's like I have no doubt that this is the offspring of Anakin Skywalker. It's like, is that needed?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we need that.
Yeah, especially that also clunks up the viewing order. Like, if we are to go by Lucas saying that we're supposed to watch this episode 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, that just throws it all out the window. That one change up in the dialogue.
Yeah. Can we talk about the big reveal since we're already
Before we do that, since we're still talking about the changes, I want to point out my favorite special edition change, and that's opening up the windows of Cloud City.
Oh yeah, so good.
Because it is gorgeous, and if you lived in the clouds, wouldn't you want that view?
Yeah,
absolutely. And seeing that in 1997.
I mean, Cloud City at golden hour is absolutely beautiful.
Mm-hmm. But can you remember the first time you saw that?
Oh, yeah.
In the theater? That was just breathtaking.
I gasped.
I
remember distinctly the first time I saw it.
What about the addition of the Rancor? That we actually got to see the Rancor.
You mean the Wampa?
The Wampa, there we go. I'm getting my creatures converted. Yeah, the seeing of the Wampa.
I do like the Wampa. I think it's a great puppet and costume combination. It's certainly better than the sock puppet version of the Wampa from the original edition. Mm-hmm. But the most unnecessary change in all of the special editions is the added scene of Vader returning to his Star Destroyer from Cloud City.
Yeah,
that adds absolutely nothing. And I'm sure it's because Lucas said, hey, how does Vader get back to his Star Destroyer after Luke falls down the shaft?
Hidden today in questions and no one was asking.
Which, yeah. I don't think I had ever noticed that he was back on a Star Destroyer. And if I did, it's like, oh, I guess he went back to his ship. Who cares?
Yeah, the original one was just prepare my shuttle. And then they extend that to prepare the Star Destroyer for my arrival. Like, did we really need all of that?
Do you think that came from a particularly horrific fan interaction Lucas had at some point, where like some annoying nerd just stopped him and was like, but how exactly did Vader get back from
a wizard did it.
A space wizard did it.
Yeah,
specifically Vader. Yeah. He is a space wizard.
Speaking, I mean, now that I mentioned the Wampa, we do have to backtrack a bit. We've mentioned it in the holiday special. Let's kind of talk about the changes to Luke Skywalker's face. Most Mark Hamill, we talked about it, wasn't an accident. Had a facial reconstructive surgery. They kind of plastered him with a lot of makeup for that holiday special.
And that was before he'd had any sort of reconstructive surgery, I think. It was just, they were just covering up the scars at that point with makeup.
Yeah. So they had the Wampa kind of rough him up a bit. Scratch his face, and that was to be the explanation of why Luke looks somewhat different in this movie versus the previous.
It's similar to River Phoenix and the Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade getting the whip to the face to explain Harrison Ford's scar as an adult. Mm.
And you know, I mean, that's fine. I don't have a problem with it. Mm. If you want to,
they didn't have to, but it was interesting that they took that time to explain it.
Yeah, like, I mean, I don't hate it.
Which is more than they would have do what more than they would do years later, never really explaining how Anakin got a scar in the movies. In other media, they've explained it, but they never really explained it in the movies.
I think that's I think just to illustrate the time passed between Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith. Mm.
So speaking of Anakin, speaking of Luke, let's get back to what you want to talk about. Let's talk about the big reveal. The reveal that shocked the world at the time. No, Luke, I am your father.
I wanted to talk about how they actually did this on the day.
Oh, yeah. I love that story. Go ahead.
Because it is a great story. We talked about in the last movie about how little David Prowse knew about his own character. To the point of they didn't even tell him that his lines were going to be dubbed over by James Earl Jones. Well, they continued that tradition in this movie because, in case you didn't know, David Prowse didn't know what that line was.
Nobody knew. Apparently,
nobody did. They actually pulled Mark Hamill aside just before filming. Mark Hamill didn't even know. In the script, it said Obi-Wan killed your father. Which, is accurate. I mean, it's not a lie. Mm-hmm.
From a certain point of view.
From a certain point of view. But so they pulled Mark Hamill aside for like last minute makeup or something, pulled him into a back room and they were
supposedly
like,
supposedly in this room was Irvin Krishner, George Lucas and Mark Hamill only.
Yeah.
Hamill told the story.
Yeah, and they were like, okay, Mark, when James Earl Jones reads the line, it will be, no, Luke, I am your father, and that is the big reveal. That is what you need to prepare as an actor to react to. This is the truth of the story. That is the reveal. Luke is Vader's son. You can't tell anybody. Have fun.
The reason they didn't tell David Prowse is because he's notorious for just talking about spoilers in interviews.
Oh, the original Tom Holland.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, he had accidentally spoiled this as a joke in coming up with stupid crap that could happen in a future Star Wars movie. He actually came up with this idea. And in fact, nobody took it seriously. And it was only years later somebody refound the interview and were like, oh my god, David Prowse really knew the true story all along. He didn't. He admitted later he didn't even remember giving that interview.
I mean, George Lucas didn't know the entire story from the beginning, so.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, there was no way Lucas wanted Vader to be Luke's father in the original Star Wars.
Yeah, but it was just David Prowse had a tendency to just be like, yeah, and R2 created 3PO out of his mind using the Force or something. You know, he would just say random stuff in interviews just to get a rise out of people. And one of the things he said was like, oh, yeah, Vader is totally Luke's father. And, you know, Leia falls in love with Chewbacca and, you know, so he actually didn't know, and nobody on set knew, and in fact, there were only three people that knew until the premiere. And bravo to Mark Hamill, because Mark Hamill has proven consistently he is number one secret keeper ever.
Well, considering the final episode of season 2 of The Mandalorian.
Mark Hamill can keep a secret like nobody's business, given the number of properties he has been in at this point in his career.
Yeah.
Mark Hamill can keep a spoiler. Bravo to Mark Hamill.
The other person who knew was Larry Kasdan.
Well, yeah.
The screenwriter.
It's interesting that, but also I kind of like that performance because Mark Hamill had like 5 minutes to come up with how do you react to that sort of earth-shattering news.
Yeah, the most evil being you've ever seen is your father. How do you react to
the
that?
Guy you've been the guy sent who, to kill.
Yeah.
The guy who just cut off your hand.
Yeah.
Which actually makes sense to the scene earlier in the cave where Luke cuts off the fantasy Vader's head and the helmet explodes, revealing his own face.
As a kid, I never realized that was Luke's face.
Mm.
I'm not sure why.
The interesting thing is that I was watching this with a friend, as I have a tendency to do, and we were talking about it, and we talked about the fact that we know so many people over the years who are like, this scene makes no sense. And it's like, no, this scene makes perfect sense. It's twofold. Like, if you continue down the path you're on, you're going to become Vader. Also, you're related to Vader.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's perfect symbolism. It makes perfect sense. And
like, by the end of the movie, you know exactly what this scene means.
Yoda tells him exactly what's in the cave, too. He says, what's in there is what you take with you.
Yeah, your anger, which will turn you into a being like Vader. Also the reveal that you are related to Vader.
And Luke took his weapons in with him, even though Yoda said, don't take your weapons.
Yeah.
He took his anger and his violence with him.
Yeah. And to go back to the reveal, the story that James Earl Jones says, he's in the recording studio recording those lines, and he looks at George Lucas and says, Vader's lying, isn't he? He can't be. There's no way Darth Vader can be Luke Skywalker's father. And James Earl Jones says, he was told, oh, yeah, he's totally lying. He's totally lying. Just, you know, well, when we get to the next movie, it'll be revealed to be a big lie. And we all know that didn't go that way. But that James Earl Jones was so invested in the story at that point that he was like, this can't be right. There's no way this is right.
You wouldn't do that to our precious little cinnamon roll, Luke, who, by the way, is the most insufferable whiny emo kid in this film.
Well, I mean, it continues on from Star Wars.
Well, yeah. But do you not, more than any other installment in the series, I think, do you not want to smack this kid in this film?
Does pretty much the opposite of everything that's going on. He complains the entire time, I can't do this. This is impossible. And then you have everyone else saying it's only impossible if you believe it's impossible.
But, I mean, did you see those guns?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's true. Mark Hamill was a bit of a snack in this movie. But he was a whiny, annoying snack.
Yeah. Well, especially the first test that Yoda gives him. Being the nuisance that he is when he's first revealed, he's testing Luke at that point, and Luke fails miserably.
But even before that, Luke absolutely does not take any piece of reasonable advice from any character at any point during this story. Not even just Yoda. Like, R2 very reasonably says, like, can you check your scanners again? Because that seems like a planet of, like, you know, 95% droid-eating humidity. Can we not go down there? And he's like, no, I'm sure it'll be fine. Seconds later, R2 is eaten by a swamp monster on the planet of droid-eating humidity. No, sure, Luke, that was fine. Okay.
My teacher, who I knew for about 12 hours, told me to go.
Yeah, this also being the first introduction of the Force Ghosts.
Yeah, the hallucination I had
while dying.
Near death totally told me to come to the death planet that eats droids. I'm sure we'll be fine.
The hallucination of a guy I spent most of a day with once.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And don't worry, this annoying backwards talking Muppet will totally save us.
And it's also the disappointment that Luke has when he's told that Yoda was a great warrior, and here is this green Muppet that is 2 feet tall, just like, this is the great warrior Yoda.
You know, I think that the one thing that I got so annoyed with Yoda about is, like, he's got that great line about, like, you know, I mean, look at me, judge me by my size, do you? And I'm like, yeah, Yoda, he has judged you by your size. He is, like, Judgy McSize Judgerton. That is the only thing he has done since he landed on Dagobah. He looked at you and immediately was like, oh, look at your size. I am going to judge you. What part of this have you not gotten?
Can we talk about Frank Oz's performance for a second, though, as Yoda?
Oh, yeah, so good.
Because, like, how does he infuse so much emotion and real real expression into that voice?
Oh, so good. And he bounces back and forth. It is that moment when Luke just kind of loses his temper and is like, we're never going to get to Yoda if you don't shut up and stop eating your porridge or whatever.
That sigh.
And that sigh when it goes from, like, I can't teach him, Obi-Wan, you're an idiot. You have sent me a completely worthless teenager send him back to his room. I am going to sit here and eat my swamp porridge. Like, you know, and from that moment, you're like, that is a completely different character in 5 seconds.
Yeah.
And further down, when he gets, when he starts getting mean, it's like, you will be afraid. You will be. That delivery is just, as a kid, that does scare you.
Yeah, it's a little creepy.
The range of emotion and the attitude, the body positioning that he gets from that puppet, you get this kind of weird, bouncy, it's a very Muppety performance at first, which the audience would have been kind of primed for because Muppets were really big at the time. So you would have been like, oh, this is a goofy Muppet. It would have shocked the audience at the time that this is not Yoda. This is not the wise master. But then very quickly, like, his posture changes. And then he becomes this kind of wise Buddha figure. And then he becomes angry. And then he becomes very serene and exasperated. And I mean, it's just, I am shocked by that performance every time I watch it.
And somehow they managed to make a puppet exude a kind of quiet power. Like,
yeah, you believe this puppet is levitating a spaceship.
Like, that is my absolute favorite Yoda moment, is his speech to Luke about what makes the Jedi the Jedi. These luminous beings are we, not this crude matter. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most beautiful things. It's one of the most beautiful performances in all of Star Wars, and it gets me every time just how powerful Yoda is.
And even though he is kind of grinding Luke because he's kind of being a Richard, as if you will, but he's also showing that he cares about him. He's saying, you know, if you go to Cloud City to save your friends, you could be putting them in even more danger. You could ruin what they fought for, and you could even ruin yourself.
You are not ready to face the most, I mean, knowing what we know now about the backstory of Anakin. Mm-hmm. This is one of the most powerful concentrations of the Force the Jedi ever saw. He murdered an entire group of children without blinking. That is the concentration of evil we're dealing with here. That is the ruthlessness we're dealing with here. And your punk behind is going to just wander in there and say, give me back my friends because I said so and I got a lightsaber now. You are going to get your rear handed to you and all of your friends are going to die. And I would like to save at least one child from this fate. Sit your butt down, boy, and listen.
And Yoda is absolutely right, because Luke does nothing to change the situation on Cloud City.
And barely escapes with his life.
Like, he actually put them in more danger because they had to go back for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, and if he had not gone, Han still would have been frozen. Leia, Lando, and Chewie would have still flown away. And then, like, Luke did nothing except learn the truth about his father.
And lose a hand.
A truth that even Yoda was kind of hinting at that he wasn't ready to hear.
It's interesting to me that the first movie was very much this kind of, here's an epic adventure. And then the second movie was like, we've got them hooked. Let's have an epic internal adventure.
I mean, there's more action in that first half hour on Hoth than it is in the rest of the movie. And I think that's by design, to get people who watched the first movie to kind of get them back into the mood of the first film. And then they really drive home the emotional part.
Yeah, it's really overall a very quiet movie.
And I think that is, Irvin Christian's directing. I don't think that would have been there if Lucas was actually directing that film.
Even the sword fight between Luke and Vader is very understated.
It takes its time. It's a very well choreographed piece.
Oh, it's
I like it as a fight, but it is more about what's going on with them internally than it is about any kind of struggle for power.
And you can tell at any point Vader could have killed Luke right then and there, but he chooses not to, because he is on one hand trying to turn Luke to his side, but also, as he says, complete the training. He's also trying to teach Luke.
And he even lets slip to Luke that he's not really happy following the Emperor.
No, yeah, together we can destroy the Emperor.
Yeah, you know, it's a really good father-son bonding moment. Murdering an old guy.
Yeah.
Like, it is a really interesting kind of setup.
I mean, like, that's kind of what happens in the third movie.
But, I mean, it is. It is what ends up happening. It just doesn't follow through the way Vader wants it. Yeah. But it is kind of an interesting, tee-up for that. Like, you know, it'd be really funny, like, if we murdered an old guy together. Wouldn't that be funny? I mean, if you were down for it. But you wouldn't be down for it, right? I mean, yeah, unless you were.
Also, guy happens to be king of the universe.
I mean, we could be king of the universe, but you wouldn't be down for that, would you? Would you? Like,
also part of the plan is to freeze Luke in the carbonite and present him to the Emperor. So he's already playing both sides here. So if Luke can turn, they're going to go kill the Emperor together. If Luke doesn't turn, he can still freeze him and he'll be a nice decoration piece for the Emperor's throne room.
Yeah. Or Han survived the carbonite process. Wouldn't it be a really interesting Trojan horse? Look, I have brought you the frozen body of Skywalker's son, who is still alive and armed with his lightsaber, and all I have to do is push this button and he will unfreeze and murder you.
We know
later that, you know, he would have probably, you know, come out of it not being able to see and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Really,
but
really sweaty for some reason.
Yeah.
Carbonite sickness is
By the way, the carbon freezing chamber has some of my favorite sound design in all of Star Wars.
The lightsaber actually has mine because of what it is made of. It is made of the vacuum tubes from an old TV set and the click from a 35mm projector. Mm-hmm. So it is actually made up of television and film, which are my two favorite things.
Yep. And then the way Ben Burtt recorded it was he would play it from a speaker he would hold in his hand and wave the speaker in front of the microphone at the same time to mimic what was happening on screen.
Yeah, man, I love Ben Burtt.
Ben Burtt is a genius.
Ben Burtt, perhaps you may have heard of him.
So speaking of the carbonite process, let's talk how Harrison Ford wanted out. And this was supposed to be the end of Han Solo. Harrison Ford wanted to be, you know, he wanted to get out of Star Wars. He was already going to do Indiana Jones, which we've already talked about. During Raiders of the Lost Ark, he wanted the character to die. You know, the character had no past, no family, and this was his way of getting out of this franchise.
Really doesn't like sequels, it seems.
Harrison Ford is also a curmudgeon who does not always know what is best for his own career.
I mean, he had the big discussion with Mark Hamill, and Mark Hamill trying to figure out, you know, the motivations of the characters and where's the greater world of Star Wars, and Harrison Ford tells him, it ain't that kind of movie, kid.
But it is. I mean, we've just discussed it is that kind of movie.
Yeah.
I'm just not sure Harrison Ford is that deep.
I just think he doesn't like science fiction.
He just likes to smoke weed and fly his planes.
Yeah.
At the same time, and he crashes them.
He's a carpenter who accidentally ended up an actor. I like the guy, but, you know.
Like I said, he wanted to do other things, and he wanted out, and he wanted the character to be straight up killed. And he's been trying to get Han Solo killed for years, and he finally got his wish, and everyone hated it.
And then, unfortunately, Carrie Fisher died and he needed to step up, which fortunately he did.
Yeah.
And actually, that performance in Rise of Skywalker is really touching.
It is. I want to talk about Leia in this, since we, you know, just name dropped it. I really like, you know, we talked in the first movie about how Leia was never your typical princess character. Mm-hmm. And yeah. How much we respected that.
She could fire a blaster better than the boys could.
Yeah. She is even less your typical princess character in this.
Yep. And she's giving orders to the fighter pilots as they're getting ready to evacuate the base. She's staying behind while everyone else is evacuated until Han basically forces her to leave.
This is the beginning of General Leia.
She is absolutely in charge of that base.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even she's even giving General Ryakan orders.
Mm-hmm. No one ever questions her authority. You know, even Lando meets her, and after a couple of, like, you know, hey, pretty lady, which is more to rib Han than it is anything about Leia, really. It's never disrespectful in the way he says it, and she gives as good as she gets, and he never once says anything to disrespect her intellect or her ability. Yeah.
And he follows her orders once they're on the Falcon leaving Cloud City.
Yeah.
And everyone absolutely respects that she knows what she's doing. She has her wheelhouse, and with the exception of the kind of tete-a-tete with Han, which we are all supposed to see as flirtatious rather than any serious challenge to her authority.
Han is being a bit of a coitus guy.
Yeah, he is being a bit of a coitus guy. I do not like the fact that he grabs her and kisses her.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that.
In this film, yeah.
He does force himself upon her.
Consent is key. Always, yes. Get consent. Always get consent.
Also, Leia is kind of a bit racist against Wookiees, it seems.
Yeah, I've always had a problem with that I'd rather kiss a Wookiee line, because
she calls him a walking carpet in the first movie, and
yeah. But I've always had a problem with the I'd rather kiss a Wookiee line, because who would not want to kiss a Wookiee? It is a giant, sentient, adorable furball.
He's a big 7-foot-tall puppy.
He is. He is a big 7-foot-tall puppy who is very smart and can fix a spaceship and looks like he is very warm and fuzzy and snuggly, and you kind of want to boop a snoot. Like, who would not kiss a Wookiee?
And also, he's probably a better pilot than Han.
Yeah, he is definitely a better pilot than Han. What gives, Leia? Like, did a Wookiee shed in your Cheerios one day and you just were like, that's it, I have had it with these MFN Wookiees on my MFN Falcon? Like, I don't know.
There's a reason Chewbacca didn't hug Leia after Han died.
I guess. I mean,
Chewie's still mad he never got a medal.
Yeah. I mean, like, she had to die before he got that medal. Poor thing. So, yeah, okay, Leia has one drawback. I will give you that.
It's the weird flirtation between the two. Again, it starts at the beginning of the film where Han has to leave because, again, there's still a bounty on his head and he has to pay out. He still hasn't paid off that bounty. This is 3 years after the first movie, so he's been with the Rebellion 3 years and has not paid off his debts.
Which means the Rebellion probably hasn't paid off their debts.
Yeah.
Which is funny because they, at the end of Star Wars, before he comes back, they were just putting crates full of credits into his ship. What happened with that?
Who knows?
Yeah.
He got his reward and then flew off. And then, I don't know, did he lose it gambling? Did he give it back to the rebellion since he signed on?
So, yeah, he's leaving. And then, granted, yeah, the general saying, you know, you're one of our best pilots. We don't want you to go. And even Leia says, you know, oh, you don't want me to, Han says, you know, to Leia, you don't want me to go. Yeah, you're a great pilot. We don't want you to go. Oh, you don't want me to go because you're, you know, you got feelings for me and all that. And it's like, even at that point, knowing where they go afterwards, it's like Han is like really pushing things he probably shouldn't be pushing. It's not even even if Leia had legit feelings for him one way or the other, it really wasn't the right time to just go into all of that.
Could you imagine being one of those rebel troopers trying to get by in the hallway during that conversation, though?
Yeah.
Look, man, I'm just trying to get to the cafeteria. Can you have this somewhere else?
I got a repair. Can you please just move a little bit just to the side? There's
water
roots.
Closet is right behind you. Can I get past you?
The thing about it is that I'm glad the later films. I wish the later films had given a different reason for their breakup, but I'm glad the later films did kind of admit that they were not really the most stable of couples.
Oh, it's totally believable that they'd be together and like madly in love for years and then just be done.
Yeah. Like they would just one day wake up and be like, why did I ever marry you? Well, who thought this was a good idea? You know, they'd be one of those couples. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about Han because there's something that really annoyed me on this rewatch, and I'm not sure I ever quite noticed it before.
Go ahead.
So at the beginning on Hoth, Luke is out there. He's been attacked by the Wampa, and Han needs to go out at sunset to rescue him. And this rebel officer is like, no, sir, don't go out. Your tauntaun will freeze before you hit the first marker. And Han turns around and goes, well, then I'll see you in hell. And I'm like, dude.
Christian hell.
Where did that come from, though? In what universe is that an appropriate response to, please, one of our best pilots, do not go out on a suicide mission that is doomed to fail. I am worried for your safety, sir.
Well, from Han's point of view, is his friend is out there, and he's going to go one way or another. He's going to go find his friend, even if it means his own end.
Yes, I see that point.
Also, maybe Han and this officer have had kind of a contentious relationship since they arrived on Hoth.
When I first got here, you took the last bowl of oatmeal. I will see you in hell with my frozen tauntaun.
Like maybe this guy got the last pair of boots in the base store, and Han was mad about it or something like that.
Yeah, it seems like, I know they're trying to make Han look like a badass who's going to go out and save his friend no matter what. But it is such a bizarre escalation.
Or maybe this guy just really likes the tauntauns. Maybe he's the one in charge of them and doesn't want to see one freeze to death.
Also, I actually had to look up on Wikipedia, like, are tauntauns supposed to be indigenous to Hoth? Because it seems really bizarre to me that this species would evolve on a planet that it can't survive after sundown.
I seem to recall reading that they live in caves with like hot springs or something like that.
It just seems very bizarre to me as a concept. But it makes Han seems very unreasonable in this film in a strangely more unreasonable way than he did in the first film.
Maybe it's to get the audience to not feel so bad when he sort of dies at the end.
But like, that scene is like a heartstring yanking, tear jerking scene.
I guess they're just trying to paint him as a jerk with a heart of gold.
Yeah, who knows?
I think they went a little too heavy on the jerk, though.
Because he's definitely a jerk to Leia through most of the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, the sarcastic, your worshipfulness, which she does call him out on. Like, will you stop calling me that? Fine, Leia.
By the look on her face, she hates him calling her Leia more than anything else.
But also, will you quit reminding me that I had a royal title from a planet that has been completely obliterated along with everyone I ever knew and loved? Like, kind of cruel, dude.
It reminds me of the X-Wing pilot asking Cara Dune if she knew anyone because she was from Alderaan.
Yeah, hey, I see your tear tattoo. How many people did you know who died? Was it like 100, 1,000? An entire planet? Ugh. The thing to me is this movie is the dark turn of Star Wars.
Yeah. This is where, I mean, this is this is, you know, the act two where the hero falls. And
no, act two is in The Last Jedi. Sorry, that was a terrible joke. I apologize.
But, you know, this is the big, you know, the heroes fail and we need to get them to their lowest point so we can get them to their highest point in the third film.
Yeah. And it very much ends on a downer, which is wonderful. I like that it ends on a downer.
Many do. Many consider this to be the best of the original trilogy, or if not the best of the entire saga.
You know what? I think I'm going to let the Simpsons sum up the ending of this movie best.
Marge, I'm confused. Is this a happy ending or a sad ending?
It's an ending. That's enough.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a divisive ending, but it's kind of just a pause in the film, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a definitive ending. It's just kind of an act break.
Yeah. It really, honestly, I never really heard this movie being so praised and loved until Kevin Smith did it in his movies.
What did you like better, Jedi or The Empire Strikes Back?
Empire.
Blasphemy.
Empire had the better ending. I mean, Luke gets his hand cut off, finds out Vader's his father, Han gets frozen and taken away by Boba Fett. It ends on such a down note. I mean, that's what life is, a series of down endings. All Jedi had was a bunch of Muppets.
Ooh, now that's an interesting argument.
I mean, same thing with you know, hatred towards Jedi. I never really heard about it until Kevin Smith started dogging it in his movies.
There's actually a little while back, somebody unearthed some old Usenet posts back around the time of that Return of the Jedi came out. The first internet talk about Star Wars, and some people were complaining that Lucas ruined Star Wars with Return of the Jedi.
Hmm. Even back then.
Even back then in the mid-80s on when there were like five people using internet discussion boards.
And one of them was Kevin Smith.
Probably.
But, you know, even among my friend group, and we're the exact right age to have loved Ewoks, and, you know, I mean, we are that precise age. Mm-hmm. But even among my friend group, there were the people who were like, stupid little teddy bears, and, you know, it was kind of a contentious ending. I knew a couple of people who didn't like the eventual Leia is his sister reveal.
Mm-hmm. Even one I'm That's another one I'm sure Lucas did not know even when he was making Empire Strikes Back.
Oh, Carrie Fisher was very against that at the time, according to some things she said in interviews in later years. She said she, like, kind of screamed at George Lucas. She's like, you made me kiss him. That's disgusting.
I mean, and then she has the line, somehow I always knew.
Yeah, somehow I consider that the most disturbing line in all of Star Wars.
To be fair, the only reason she kisses Luke at all is to make Han jealous.
Which is, that's worse.
Which is a problematic trope.
Worse, right?
It's a problematic trope on its own, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, so, the Empire versus Jedi, which was better, I'm not sure I'm willing to lay entirely at the feet of Kevin Smith. I will say that I'm willing to say Kevin Smith made the argument cool again. Maybe a little bit more tribalistic.
And keep in mind, this was just a few years before the special editions came out.
Yeah.
And then more people would be on the internet at the time and kind of regurgitating that.
I don't know. Adam, thoughts?
I used to be on the anti-Return of the Jedi train, but I think I was that just because it was sort of the popular thing to do in Star Wars discussions at the time. And at this point in my life, I'm just happy that there's Star Wars at all.
Mm.
Like, I kind of love it all, even the not great stuff. Like, I'll sit and I'll probably will not watch The Rise of Skywalker again for some time, but I'm still glad it exists, you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't know that Kevin Smith is responsible for the Empire versus Jedi debates, or if he's responsible for people praising Empire. I know that I've always heard people love Empire Strikes Back, and I've always loved Empire Strikes Back. So,
I mean,
I'm kind of agnostic on that debate overall.
So, what else can we talk about?
Yeah, have we skipped any points, or do we want to go into the finale?
There's nothing. I don't think there's any. I mean, I just want to talk about them being inside of that creature for half the movie.
The Exegorth is what it's actually called, which is fun.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about the Exegorth a little bit.
The giant sock puppet in space.
Yeah. The giant asteroid creature. What is this thing eating?
Wayward starships.
Okay. Space.
Cosmic rays.
Is big.
Asteroids.
Like, really big?
Mm-hmm.
Like, really, really big? Super duper big. Even like, if
you may
this
think it's
thing...
a long walk down to the corner of the chemist, but that's just peanuts to space.
Exactly. Thank you. I was hoping somebody would understand me. But the thing is that even if this is in a typical plotted shipping route, this asteroid cannot get enough ship debris coming through to feed a creature, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Especially one that size.
What is this thing eating? Especially to also support a colony of Minox, which apparently eat power cables, which seems like a bizarre thing to evolve a creature to eat in the reaches of space.
According to Wikipedia, Exegorths eat stellar energy emissions, mineral-rich deposits from the asteroid, floating space debris, and sometimes they would even eat the Minox.
Sure.
And then opportunistic ones could try and catch passing starships, but that much motion would exhaust them.
Sure, Wikipedia.
Someone wrote a book about trying. That. Someone wrote a book about this creature.
Also, the one in the asteroid has a name. It's Sci-O.
Of course it has a name.
S-Y hyphen capital O.
Of course it has a name.
Everything has a name in this galaxy.
Every tiny floating bit of rock in that scene has a name. There is an astral designation for every space rock in that scene.
And we spend a good portion of this movie here.
In the asteroid chase, there's one of my favorite tiny details in all of Star Wars that you couldn't see until you got a widescreen edition on home video of some sort. And that's when you see the asteroid destroy the bridge of one of the Star Destroyers. And then you cut to Vader having his little conference with all the holograms of the other captains. And you see one of them sort of look up to the side, raise his arms, and then fuzz out of existence. And I think that's such a great tiny little detail.
Yeah, I love it when they put in little things like that.
And it's like, it's not called out. There's no like sound effects or nobody mentions it. It's just, you see the establishing shot outside. You see the one Star Destroyer get hit by an asteroid right on the bridge. And then you cut inside to see the captain die over a hologram. And it's just great.
Oh, Brock's gone. So.
Yeah. But I do have to say that it actually, that whole thing ends with, probably one of the most smartest moves Han ever does in the entire series is kind of hitching a ride on the Star Destroyer. You know, hiding the Millennium Falcon essentially in plain sight.
Oh, and then Carrie Fisher has the best line reading ever when he talks about how they dump their trash before they go to hyperspace and then we just float away. And Carrie and Leia says, with the rest of the garbage.
Yeah. Although I do wonder... Reading. I do wonder, because we know that that Fett figured out that the ship was there and what Han's plan was, and I wonder if there was just like a dude in Mandalorian armor just sitting to the side as like Imperial admirals and Vader were running around the ship being like, but they can't have a cloaking device, they're too small, but did they go, you know, to the hyperdrive or like, you know, all this kind of stuff, and like there's just like a dude with a Mandalorian mask going like, tee-hee, tee-hee. Like, how many hours did he sit there just waiting for like, is it garbage dump time yet? But, okay, so I want to talk about the big retcon that mostly comes from this movie. Mm-hmm. The Millennium Falcon is sort of sentient.
Oh, yes.
How do we feel about this movie having seen Solo?
I kind of like it. I like, you know, it used to be in Legends that the Falcon's onboard computer was comprised of three droid brains that hated each other.
Which makes sense since it barely functions, yeah.
Yeah, and which is why 3PO says, I don't know where your ship learned to communicate. And I kind of like that having the essence of L3 in there kind of has the same effect.
But I also kind of wonder now if that scene, like, you know, if the conversation between 3PO and the Falcon is like, you know, hi, we need to run away from a bunch of Imperial Star Destroyers, and L3's like, no, you need to get rid of your chains of human servitude is what you need to do. And 3PO is like, I don't know where your ship learned to communicate. This is all gibberish.
You know? Okay, yes, fine. I agree. But first off, where's the hyperdrive?
Yeah.
And, you know, it is eventually R2 that fixes the whole thing. And you got to wonder what R2 said to L3 to make that happen.
Well, he just flipped a switch because it looks like the sabotage they did to the Falcon was really simple to fix.
You know what R2 probably said was, "Oh, trust me, we are on our way to deliver the final package to eradicate the human menace as we speak. I just need the hyperdrive to work." And L3's like, "Oh, on it."
But also, 3PO said, R2 told 3PO that the CD Central computer told him what was wrong with the hyperdrive.
Yeah.
Another in the long line of 3PO just denigrating and talking down to R2 as if he doesn't know what he's doing.
I will say that I kind of like it because I've always liked the Falcon as a ship. And when I saw L3, I was like, oh my goodness, this is me if I were a droid. I'm serious, though. Both of you know me. Tell me L3 is not me if I were a droid.
Oh, no, absolutely.
Which makes her fate even more tragic, because she wanted freedom, and now she's forever essentially a servant as part of the ship.
Once again, you've met me.
Yeah.
But now she's got Lando back.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Trust me, it works.
It works somehow. But I don't know. I think it kind of was interesting to me watching it again, because I don't think I had watched Empire all the way through since I've seen Solo.
And they even had a joke about Han hitting the console to make it turn on. That's actually, they made that a thing in Solo.
This still remains, I'm not going to say that it's my favorite Star Wars movie. I have very controversial opinions about Star Wars movies.
I think it's sort of, in a way, very mirrors the Disney trilogy, in that you had the one that's the big feel-good movie in the first movie. You have the turn in left field that is the second movie. And we need to go back to the feeling of the first movie with the third.
Yeah, it's a very traditional story structure, you know. Lucas didn't, like, really invent anything with this pattern.
True.
They were working from very kind of ancient patterns here. But I would say this is probably my second favorite Star Wars film.
Yeah, I can see that.
The order in which I list my favorite Star Wars movies is always changing. Yeah. Depending on my mood, except for the fact that the prequels are always the bottom three, although that order changes among them as well. And like, I hate the prequels a lot less than I used to, but I'm still not a fan. But Empire Strikes Back, it's always up near the top for me. I'd put it, sometimes it's my favorite, sometimes it's my second favorite. It tends to swap places with The Last Jedi a lot.
Yeah.
Which is another of my favorites.
Last Jedi. Yeah, Last Jedi is currently my favorite right now. I mean, ask me tomorrow. I'm very much like you. Ask me tomorrow, maybe not. But right now, Last Jedi is my current favorite.
But my rewatch for this recording is the first time I've watched Empire in a long time. And I really enjoyed watching that movie for this. It's well put together. The acting is for the most part really, really good. And
especially Frank Oz, who is just so stellar.
Frank Oz turns in a hell of a performance. James Earl Jones has some great, people complain about the choke on your aspirations line from Rogue One. But I mean, that's the same joke as apology accepted, Captain Nita.
Yeah. Going back to this, that made me think of that line. It's like, oh yeah, Vader was always doing these kind of things.
And that is a very consistent characterization, even with Anakin in the prequels. He does the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anakin has a really weird sense of humor.
Yeah. Anakin is very dad joke.
Well, I mean, he's a dad. It comes with the territory.
We should have known.
Yeah. All right. I think that's all we can really talk about this movie. So let's ask the question, does Empire Strikes Back have the magic?
Yes, of course. I
mean, yes, it's Star Wars.
Yes, it's Star Wars.
I mean, it literally has magic in it. It has space wizards.
Most pointless question ever.
So, I think that's, I think that's everything we can say about Empire Strikes Back. So let's move on to next week, as we are doing a bit of an experiment for next week, as we are dedicating the entire rest of May to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, specifically a 7-day period known as Fury's Big Week. Now, for those of you who don't know what that is, it's most of Phase 1 takes place in a 7-day period. I'm not sure how it works either, but we're going to find out how. So we're going to start with The Incredible Hulk, the 2008 version with Edward Norton. No, it is not on Disney Plus. Yes, we will find a way to watch it. So tune into that. See our reactions and rewatching The Incredible Hulk and trying to figure out how all of this fits in one week.
I'm really looking forward to listening to that.
Yeah, before we go, we are going to thank Adam for being with us yet again, our first three-peat.
Thank you very much for having me. I always love coming on. It's a lot of fun to talk about this stuff.
We're always glad to have you.
Yeah, please tell everybody where they can find you online and what you may be doing.
You can find me at Big Bass Bone. That's BigBassBone on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok for some reason. I don't really do a whole lot on those platforms, but occasionally I'll show up and post a picture or yell at a politician on Twitter or duet somebody on TikTok. If you'd like to check out my band, the world famous Poxy Boggards, we're a folk band that does very, very dirty music, and it's a lot of fun. And we also do serious folk music as well. And you can find us at poxyboggards.com. That's POXYBOGGARDS, or The Poxy Boggards on Facebook or Instagram, what have you. Check us out. We're a lot of fun, and we can't wait to go back to performing next year at the Renaissance Fair.
Yeah, they are very fun. I enjoy them quite a bit.
All right, so that's all for right now. Come back next week for The Incredible Hulk, and we will talk to you all then. Bye!
Go Bye-bye. Watch a Star Wars!
Don't let the magic stop here.
Join our conversation online on Facebook at Rewatching the Magic.
Twitter at Rewatch the Magic.
And, of course, new episodes every week at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com.
Remember, the magic is for everyone.
It only stops if you let it.